in this hour of the show, we have as our guest David Cohen. He is director of the War Crimes Study Center at the University of California at Berkeley, and he is one of the world's leading experts on both war crimes and war crimes trials. He is here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk on this very subject tonight at 7:30. This is part of the MillerCom series. His talk will take place at the Levis Center on Illinois Street in Urbana. Has a number of joint sponsors in addition to the MillerCom folks, including the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities and the Program in Jewish Culture and Society, and a number of others. All of these events are always free and open to the public. If you would like to attend and hear him, you certainly should feel welcome to do that. And here on this program as well, if you have questions, comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, you're invited to do that too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if you'd like to call in. By the way, I do also want to mention one other event that our guest will be involved in. There will be a panel discussion on war crimes, restitution, and reconciliation. He'll be joining with some members of the faculty here from the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, and this will be tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the College of Law Auditorium. So a couple of opportunities to hear some discussion of these issues, and of course here on the program as well. Your questions are welcome. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know if this is too basic a question, but I guess I feel like starting out and actually asking you to talk about what is a war crime, just because I would think that maybe in some people's minds it might not be so clear, or that there might be cases where it was not so clear, simply because, you know, war is about killing, it's about destruction, and what separates what goes on, what is a normal, and that's a strange way to talk about it, but what is a normal, and we'll put that in quotes, what is a normal part of war, fighting, and a war crime? What exactly is the difference?
Well, to define a war crime, first we have to define the kinds of acts that are war crimes, and then we also have to define the context in which those acts occur. Mm-hmm. A war crime occurs during an armed conflict, and that's probably the in terms of the law of war crimes that's being applied by war crimes tribunals around the world. One of the first questions that has to be asked is there an armed conflict? Is it an international armed conflict, or is it a non-international, a purely internal armed conflict? If there's no armed conflict, it can't be a war crime. It may be a crime against humanity. It may be genocide, maybe some other kind of human rights violation. But a war crime takes place during an armed conflict. What distinguishes particular kinds of acts that occur during war or armed conflicts from those kinds of killings that you were talking about that seem to be the routine business of war, is who they're directed against and under what circumstances. So in principle, and, you know, there's a body of law and custom that has evolved over several centuries on this, war is supposed to be directed, or the killing business of war is supposed to be directed at killing the soldiers of the enemy and not the civilians, not the women and children, the bystanders and so forth who aren't wearing uniforms, who aren't fighting. So a deliberate attack against civilians in which the object, for example, is to kill civilians is probably the purest form of war crime. Killing prisoners of war who have laid down their arms and surrendered to the enemy is another classic kind of war crime. So those would be two kinds of examples. Unfortunately, because of the nature of the conflicts of the 20th century, we have a very long list of such kinds of crimes, and they include deporting civilian populations, enslaving civilian populations, and forcing them to perform labor for an occupying power, destroying their property, exterminating them, and so on and so forth. There's mm-hmm. a, a very wide range of war crimes.
War crimes, as we think of them now, I'm sure there have always been war crimes, and yet the concept seems to be modern. The benchmark, the touchstone for the war crime and the war crimes trial probably are the trials that took place after World War II, and Nuremberg, which is the better known one, and then there also was one at which Japanese military people and leaders were also tried. Did the concept before Nuremberg, did the concept exist?
Well, surprisingly, the concept is very old. That is, the notion that there are some limits on what countries or people should do in time of war is a very old one, and in the West goes back to the very earliest historical sources that we have. Unfortunately, so does the tendency not always to obey these rules or customs. But among the ancient Greeks, for example, there were notions that when a city surrendered, the women and children were not to be enslaved, the male population was not to be killed, for example. After classical antiquity, during the Middle Ages, there are attempts to try to develop rules in this area, and several hundred years ago, you have philosophers and lawyers like Hugo Grotius, the Dutch sort of international lawyer, who wrote a huge treatise on the law of war and peace, which was very influential in shaping European thinking over the centuries. So the idea of having limitations on war is an old one. The idea of developing international mechanisms to enforce those rules is distinctively modern. Mm. And that is the contribution of the second half of the 20th century that you referred to.
How are we doing?
Well, it depends on what standard we use to measure that. Considering that we were starting from scratch, we could only make progress. On the other hand, we are by no means, I think, where we would like to be in terms of the effectiveness of the mechanisms that we have. But there's been striking developments and progress, if you will, since the end of the Cold War, because it was the end of the Cold War that really enabled the international community for the first time since Nuremberg and Tokyo, the first and last international tribunals for war crimes. It was the end of the Cold War that enabled the international community to begin to follow through on the dream of those who set up the post-World War II war crimes trials, which was to have a permanent international mechanism, a kind of permanent international criminal court. And we have that now.
Hmm. Although it's all nations don't acknowledge it.
No, all nations don't acknowledge it, and the United States and China are certainly the leading nations that don't acknowledge it. On the other hand, we're getting, I haven't looked in the last few months at the list of countries that have ratified, but it's somewhere around 100. So there are certainly a large number of countries that have signed on to the program of the International Criminal Court.
I should introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus, anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're speaking with David Cohen. He's professor of rhetoric and classics. He also is the director of the War Crime Studies Center at the University of California at Berkeley. And he is here visiting the campus to talk about war crimes trials. We'll be giving a talk tonight and participating in a panel discussion tomorrow, and a little later on in the program, I'll give you the information on that once again if you're interested. 333-9455, the number here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call in, questions, comments are welcome. Toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you would like to talk a little bit about the War Crimes Studies Center at Berkeley and what it's all about.
Well, the War Crimes Studies Center at Berkeley has two sort of main focuses in its work. One of them goes back to what you were talking about a moment ago, which are the World War II war crimes trials. And you mentioned, well, everybody's heard about Nuremberg. And then there was this other trial. There were some Japanese leaders. Maybe it was in Tokyo. Yes, that was the Asian counterpart to Nuremberg. At the time, it was regarded as of equal importance and stature. It has faded from memory. But what has faded from memory even more were the many thousands of other war crimes trials that were conducted by approximately 20 countries across Asia, Europe, and the Pacific of German and Japanese war criminals. And one of the main tasks of the War Crime Study Center at Berkeley is to recover the records of those thousands of trials and make them available to historians, to lawyers, and students, and above all, to the new tribunals that very much need them as precedents. But those the trial records of those cases are not available because they're still in the archives, military or public archives of the countries where they occurred after World War II. So that's one strand of what we're trying to do, and we're cooperating with our German partner center and our new Chinese partner center in this effort, and it's a very, very big task. The second prong of our activities focuses on the contemporary world and on the war crimes trials that are taking place today at the national and international level in many places. A lot of people are aware of the Milosevic trial and the activities of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, where Milosevic is being tried in The Hague. It's reported on. Reporters like to go there. It's in Europe. It's near Amsterdam. It gets a lot of coverage. The tribunals that are working in Africa and in Asia receive much less coverage, unfortunately. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to increase public awareness of those trials, to make documents from those trials available, to monitor the trials and report on them and draw international attention to when they are not meeting international standards and so forth.
You quite rightly noted the way I talked about the two war crimes, the ones in Japan and in Germany. And I think that it is true that's for somehow Nuremberg has this place in people's minds, and that the war crimes trials that took place in Japan that you say at the time were considered to be as important have faded from memory. People do have this sort of vague notion like, well, I think there also were war crimes trials in Japan, but people don't have that kind of a strong sense of it that they do about Nuremberg. Why is that?
Well, I think there are a variety of reasons. And, you know, I wasn't making fun of you. That's the normal response. I mean, that's the way international lawyers who are in this business talk about it as well. And I think that tells us something. I mean, that even experts who know a lot about Nuremberg are, on the whole, very fuzzy about what it exactly was that happened in Tokyo. So I think, first of all, Nuremberg happened first. It riveted world attention. It was a very dramatic trial. It included war crimes that really shocked the world, and that in one way were sort of difficult to imagine, but in another way were sort of easy to focus on. Auschwitz became a symbol, for example, of Nazi iniquity. The Tokyo trials began, well, ended, they took a very long time. That's another factor. Nuremberg was over in about 11 months, the whole process. Tokyo dragged on for about 2.5 years. By the time it ended in 1948, the world was tired of war crimes trials. The Cold War had started. Attention was focused on other problems. So even at the time, it didn't sort of capture the public imagination in the way that Nuremberg did. The crimes for which Japanese war criminals were tried at Tokyo are far less known. That's another factor. There's no, I mean, Japanese war crimes in their scale, geographic scope, barbarity, and so forth, I think are as horrific as many of the crimes that were tried at Nuremberg. But they're more diffuse. There's no equivalent of Auschwitz that you can use as a sort of symbol of them. Now, of course, I'm saying all this really speaking from the Western perspective. If you ask people in China, for example, you'll get a very different answer about this. Japanese war crimes and trials and so forth have not been forgotten in China, where the memory of the Nanjing massacre and other similar massacres is very much alive, where there have been recent developments, in fact, reparations concerning Japanese bacteriological and chemical warfare in China, in places like Korea and the Philippines. The issue of the comfort women is very much alive. But from the Western perspective, you know, it seems farther away, more remote, less important. You know, we simply don't have, you know, something like the Holocaust, which for a Western public sort of continues to preoccupy them in the way that it does for Nuremberg.
We have several callers, and we will bring them into the conversation. Let us go. We have someone on cell phone, so we'll go there first. Caller is north of Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hi, am I on?
Yes.
Okay. You just gave the answer, and then you backed away from it. The bottom line, as far as I can tell, is that the atrocities of the Holocaust were committed by white Westerners, and it was the white Westerners who were horrified that people like us can do things like that. I don't think we have the same attitude towards Asians committing atrocities or Africans committing those atrocities, and so I think there's a very strong racial element in what pulls our attention when we realize that people like us can do that kind of terrible thing. Thank you very much.
All right. Do you think that that is true?
I think there's an element. I think there's an element of truth in it. I don't think it's entirely. I don't think it's the whole story. I mean, the reactions to Japanese and German war crimes were similar in many ways, and the vocabulary that was used to describe them of sort of barbarity and shock and so forth, was quite similar. But on the other hand, I mean, I think, you know, that the caller is right in saying that the it was easier to think that, oh, well, we couldn't really expect the Japanese to uphold civilized standards anyway. I think there is probably an element of that.
Yeah. Well, that I suppose that would suggest that if you took a look at the war crimes trials that are going on or that are projected now, they're going on. There's the trial regarding war crimes in the former Yugoslavia that's going on, but there also have been trials organized for the conduct of the Indonesian government in Timor, and also for Rwanda and for Sierra Leone. So we've got Africa, we've got Asia, we've got Europe. What's going on in The Hague, the Milosevic trial, has gotten more attention than those others? Is that the reason, or does it have to do with the fact that part of it is interest in Mr. Milosevic himself?
Well, I mean, certainly there's a lot of interest in Milosevic himself, and his decision not to be represented by counsel and conduct the trial himself has added an element of melodrama and sometimes sort of grotesque comedy and so on to the proceedings. But, you know, as I mentioned before, there's absolutely no question that much more attention is paid by the international press and the international community to the trials in The Hague than to the counterpart tribunal, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which until recently shared the same chief prosecutor, Carla Del Ponte, and is very much an equal tribunal in principle. But the number of reporters who find their way to Arusha, Tanzania, to report on those trials is far fewer. And even though in many ways, I think, in terms of the development of international law, those trials have been more important than the trials in The Hague, they are covered less. And I think it is because they're in Africa. And you mentioned the new Sierra Leone tribunal. Trials haven't started yet, but they will soon. There's very little awareness that there's a tribunal there. One of the reasons that my center is going to get active there is because nobody's planning on monitoring those trials. And so that's something that we're going to try to do. So, and above all, I think the reason that we have a tribunal in The Hague where Milosevic and others are being tried is because those war crimes were committed in Europe. Bosnia is part of Europe, and there was a conviction in the European Union. I think, and I'm not unfair to put it this way, that, well, these things might happen in Africa or Asia, but they don't happen in Europe, and they can't be permitted to happen in Europe at the end of the 20th century. And so that tribunal was established where we hadn't had similar efforts to establish tribunals for equally horrific crimes that were committed elsewhere. And I don't think it's coincidental that the Rwanda tribunal was created after the Yugoslav tribunal, in part because I think it would have been too embarrassing not to create a tribunal for the Rwanda genocide after having just created one for the war in Bosnia. Hmm.
Well, let me ask you one other question, and I promise that the callers that we'll get back to them. I think that there are some people who are concerned about and raise questions about the resources that have been dedicated to actually doing these things. And I'm sure that having a war crimes trial it's very complicated, and it costs money. It's expensive to do. And I think some people, and I think you've been one of them, have said, you know, maybe we've got a problem here because if you try to do it on the cheap, you're not going to be able to do it right. And yet it seems that we don't, all of these various cases that we've talked about, they don't have the same resources to put behind the whole proceeding.
Well, that's absolutely right. And the trials in The Hague for the former Yugoslavia and the trials in Arusha, Tanzania for the Rwanda genocide are hugely expensive. The annual budget for the Yugoslav tribunal is about $110 million. The annual budget for the Rwanda tribunal is about $90 million. The Hague has over 1,100 permanent employees. The Rwanda tribunal, over 900. These are massive operations. They've been going on since the early 1990s, 93 and 94, respectively. The completion date for the Yugoslav tribunal is 2010. Many of us don't think they will manage to do that. When you add up the amount of resources that will have been expended on these trials and you ask what that kind of money could have done in places like Rwanda in helping towards reconstruction or rebuilding a justice system that was completely destroyed during the Rwanda genocide, we might well wonder whether those resources are being spent in the best way, which is not to say that there shouldn't be resources devoted to trials, but the scale of those resources is definitely a question. And as you rightly point out, these kinds of resources are not being lavished upon other trials, like the United Nations Tribunal in East Timor, which in 2001 had a budget of $6.1 million, $6 million of which went to the prosecution and $100,000 of which went to the tribunal, and none of which went to the public defender's office.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Cohen. He's professor of rhetoric and classics at UC Berkeley. He's also the director of the War Crimes Studies Center there at University of California, Berkeley. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk Witnessing War Crimes Trials. That's tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Center on the campus. It's a MillerCom event. Then also he'll be taking part in a panel discussion on war crimes, restitution, and reconciliation with some U of I faculty members. And that's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the College of Law Auditorium. We'll get back to our callers here. Up next, a Belgium caller over by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I don't want this to sound extremely ignorant, but I notice it's only the victors that are involved with the tribunals. And that is probably the reason why the United States doesn't want to sign in to being in the World Court, because right now we tend to be the victors of the conflicts, and we don't want our people to be accused of war crimes even though they are the victors. Because sometimes the people who win do things very bad too. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, that's certainly an important point. That's a criticism that was widely made of the World War II trials, Nuremberg and Tokyo and the others. That's not completely the case in regard to the new tribunals. For example, although it is a problem, in the Rwanda tribunal, the jurisdiction of the tribunal extends both to the Hutu power government who perpetrated the genocide, as well as to the RPF, the group which overthrew them and now constitutes the government of Rwanda. The prosecutor has been investigating and taking steps to initiate prosecutions against members of the government of Rwanda now, and this has been one of the sticking points in the relations between the government of Rwanda and the tribunal, and has also been an issue which is taken up by the Security Council. But in that case, for example, it's not only the defeated government that's the object of the tribunal's investigation. In regard to the war in Bosnia and the Yugoslav tribunal, you have defendants from all sides. There have been Muslims, Croats, and Serbs who have been convicted by the tribunal. Another mechanism that's being used to meet this kind of criticism that you're raising is what's called a hybrid international tribunal, where a proportion of the judges and the prosecutors are international, but a proportion of them come from the country where the crimes were committed.
Can I ask you about another aspect of a war crime involving the most recent aspect of war that we've been involved with, which is Iraq, in that we, or mainly Afghanistan, maybe I should say, over Iraq, we have incarcerated people in Guantanamo now for quite a while, and we don't ever bring them to trial. Wouldn't that almost constitute a war crime?
Well, it may certainly constitute a violation of the 1949 Geneva Convention number 3, which regulates the treatment of prisoners of war. During a conflict, prisoners of war may be detained until the end of the conflict, and that detention is different than a kind of criminal incarceration. The problem with the Guantanamo detainees is that the Bush administration has, and wrongly in my opinion, refused to recognize their status as prisoners of war, or even to clarify their status in the way that's mandated both by international law and by United States military law. And the standards there are quite clear, both at the international level and the United States military law level, and that is that a person who's detained during an armed conflict is presumed to be a prisoner of war until a competent tribunal decides otherwise. And the Bush administration has thus far refused to bring the Guantanamo detainees before a tribunal to adjudicate that issue. So there's definitely a conflict, I think, between the Bush administration policy and international law on this issue.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to our next caller, and that would be Champaign County and line number 2.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was reminded again about Nuremberg last night, seeing Noam Chomsky speak. He brought up again the fact that Germany as a state was charged with unprovoked attack. That was one of the other things. We mainly concentrate on individuals and individual war crimes, but there is actually a crime of war that was leveled against, you know, Germany as an entity. So I won't say any more about that. What I actually was provoked to call about was your assessment of the whole alien tort phenomena that's going on right now. These are mainly going after people who are living in this country, Guatemalan generals, people that are living in South Florida. There's a campaign, I think, to stop this. But I see this as, you were asked earlier, how is it going as far as war crimes tribunals? I see this phenomena using an 18th century law to try to get justice for people as sort of a statement that indeed the it's not going all that well, where people are having to resort to a mechanism, you know, clouded in ancient, relatively old, long ago law that perhaps isn't entirely what it was intended for, but it reads pretty well, in my opinion, I think. And as long as there's no other recourse available, it seems that this is appropriate. And it's mainly because of who they're going after and the connections with the U.S. that I think that this attack on the phenomenon, there's talk of repealing the law, et cetera, et cetera. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think the question of the alien tort claims law is certainly an interesting and a complex one. It's not, I think, a measure of the fact that we're not doing very well, because it's a mechanism that really allows individuals to pursue justice for crimes which were committed in the past. Crimes that were committed before the new mechanisms that are in place now began to function. Now, the hope would be that the International Criminal Court will provide a venue where crimes committed after the foundation of the court can properly be prosecuted. Until that's the case, I think I would agree with you that whatever this mechanism was originally designed to do, it has proved a useful tool for individuals seeking to correct past injustices.
And because of the fact that it technically would still be available to people going after people accused, U.S. people accused, U.S. servicemen, CIA agents, Dine Corps people who are working in a mercenary capacity in, say, former Yugoslavia or... Actually, I think there is one going ahead on that against Dine Corps. I remember hearing much about that. But so it would at least present the previous caller just commented on the fact that U.S. isn't stepping up to be involved in this the New World Court, but the this alien tort provision would be still available. Okay, thanks.
All right, let's go to next caller. That's Crete, Illinois, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, I was somewhat surprised by your statement about the cost of the war crimes in the Rwanda and in The Hague. I would have thought, as head of the director of the War Crimes Study Center, you would have said, we will spare no effort and spend enough money as needed to rectify the wrongs committed. Plus the fact that just because we would save some money on the side, cut back $50 million, doesn't necessarily mean we'll send it to the Serbs or Bosnians or the Tutsis. I think the logic of your reasoning is somewhat weak there. But let me go to the points that we had war crimes back in the 1860s. I don't know if your center deals with the Santee Sioux in Minnesota, but they were executed for war crimes in 1862, 35 of them, I think, at one time. I don't know if you deal with Henry Wirtz at Andersonville, but we have had a history of war crimes, at least almost 90 years before Nuremberg. I'd like you to talk about the issue that Taft raised, that's Robert Taft, in 1945 and 46 regarding ex post facto retroactive laws, and if you can comment on the Yamamoto trial, egregious trial. Go ahead.
There are a lot of questions there. I'll begin with the last one. I think you're referring to the Yamashita trial.
Yamashita, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, the Yamashita, General Yamashita was the commander-in-chief of American forces, of Japanese forces in the Philippines when the Americans invaded. I think that was the closest to a kangaroo court of any of the World War II war crimes trials, and I think that's largely due to the sort of personal vendetta of Douglas MacArthur against General Yamashita and General Homma, who was tried immediately after Yamashita and also hanged. Homma was the Japanese general who had kicked MacArthur out of the Philippines. But, you know, the part of your question that I would like to that I'd like to go back to is the issue of expense. And I think this is a very important point. There are a limited number of resources that the international community is prepared to devote to international justice. And it's, of course, a political question how those resources should be distributed. I certainly want the trials in Rwanda, the Rwanda Tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, and the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague to perform according to international standards. I don't necessarily think that trials lasting years and of the expense of some of the trials that we've had are necessary for that to happen. At the same time, I think that because the resources are limited, that there's no justification for The Hague to have resources on a scale vastly exceeding that which are available to the Sierra Leone Tribunal, which is also a United Nations tribunal, and which also must perform its mandate according to international standards. So I think, you know, the point really has to do with the way that limited resources are fairly distributed among a whole series of institutions that are trying with a UN mandate to achieve international justice.
I was just wondering about the proposal you had, that if we could cut back expenses on the trials, we could send food and equipment to the Tutsis, and I just don't think that's a workable solution to the expenses. I mean, I don't think that's an alternative.
Oh, no, I wasn't saying we should send food and equipment. My point was more a rhetorical point, which is that Rwanda is a country whose justice system was almost completely destroyed during the genocide. There was virtually, I think, not a single judge left in the country at the end of the genocide, and only a handful of lawyers. And as part of the tribunal does have an outreach program, and it's certainly not beyond the scope of the outreach program to use some of its resources of the tribunal to help rebuild the system of justice within Rwanda.
Would you talk about the ex post facto issue that Taft raised, which makes these trials look illegal, unconstitutional, practically un-American?
Well, it's not a matter of being unconstitutional because they're not bound by the United States Constitution. These were international tribunals at Nuremberg and Tokyo, and the legal basis of the tribunal was a charter in each case that was drafted by the allied powers that and other countries which created the tribunals. They were well aware at the time that the tribunals were unprecedented and that it was a political act that created them. In the face of the alternatives, I think they saw no other viable course through which they could proceed. Now, the same issue has faced the Rwanda tribunal in some ways, and the Yugoslav tribunal. It's inevitable in these kinds of circumstances, until the creation of the International Criminal Court.
Thank you.
All right, let's go on to another caller next, Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. About the prisoners in Guantanamo, those prisoners are people who were in the Al-Qaeda organization which attacked us on September 11th. By keeping them at Guantanamo, we prevent them from attacking us again. We've not been attacked again since their original attack, so holding them at Guantanamo seems to be a good policy. It seems to be working. Isn't there a danger that if we allowed them habeas corpus or the ordinary constitutional rights that we have, for other people, we would get attacked. The people who clearly want to attack us would be free to attack us again.
The issue in question is not the right of the United States to detain prisoners of war if it declares these individuals to be prisoners of war. Since the conflict in Afghanistan is continuing, I don't see any legal obstacle under international law to continuing to detain them. The issue is whether or not they should be recognized as prisoners of war and whether or not the United States has taken the steps which it's obliged to take under international law to say that they're not prisoners of war. The United States is a signatory to the Geneva Convention, and the Geneva Convention requires that if they are not to be treated as prisoners of war, the decision that they don't have that status is to be made on an individual basis by a competent tribunal. That principle is also in the United States Army, the Manual of the Law of Land Warfare, which incorporates that provision of the Geneva Convention. So there's little question that the United States is bound by that, and I think the real issue behind your question is whether or not, in the name of a perceived expediency in terms of policy, the United States is justified in not living up to its legal obligations under its own military law and international law.
Yeah, that is true, and we're in a new kind of warfare. Clearly, these people... some of them, we don't know which ones. Maybe it would be safe to release some of them. If we knew which ones, it would be safe to release. But others of them clearly wish to attack us. If we release them, they probably will attack us. That's a new kind of warfare, and there ought to be some new provisions, wouldn't you say?
Well, once again, I mean, the issue is whether or not we're going to determine that they're prisoners of war, not what we do with them afterwards. If they have committed crimes in Afghanistan or elsewhere, there is absolutely no legal obstacle to trying them for those crimes if they are prisoners of war. Prisoners of war can be tried for crimes they commit either during an armed conflict or while they're in captivity. The problem is, I think, that the Bush administration has no interest in trying them, because the real object in detaining them indefinitely is simply to interrogate them as long as possible and keep them out of the way. I think if they were declared to be prisoners of war and if they were tried, there would be no problem in incarcerating them.
I think I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I just have a couple of minutes left, and I have some other callers, and I think I want to try to get at least one more. We'll go to Urbana, line one. That's the next person up. Hello.
Yeah, I think you said that if the conflict is not international, well, that would mean that you don't cover incidents like in El Salvador in 1981, El Mazote massacre of 700 women and children, mostly, where we had backed the government of El Salvador with $6 billion in economic and military aid. So my question is, why doesn't that kind of economic and military aid to particularly brutal regimes count as an international conflict?
Well, first of all, I didn't say that if it wasn't an international conflict there couldn't be violations of international law. There's a body of law which applies to international conflicts and another which applies to non-international conflicts.
Oh, I see. I misunderstood.
Yeah, and under both of those, there's no question that massacres of civilians, torture, and so on and so forth, are violations of international law and can be prosecuted.
Well, still, it seems like there's a dearth of scrutiny when it comes to Central and South America and where we're involved, you know, and it's deafening silence. Thank you.
All right. To Chicago next, line two. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Yes, I have been hearing this all the time ever since 9-1-1 started, that we ought to... try and defend the Bill of Rights. Unfortunately, when you have times of emergency, there are certain rights you have to give up. Now, President Lincoln, when he suspended the right of habeas corpus, used it as he said, if a man has a wounded arm and he has to lose that arm to save his life, then he'll do it. I think these people in Guantanamo are not prisoners of war, they're terrorists. If they could, they'd drop a nuclear bomb on Washington or New York or even Chicago And then they'd phrase it with all kinds of, we're doing it for Allah or whatever. But I just don't want to see this country get hit again. And I think a lot of the people who are complaining about this, let's hope, for God's sake, if they don't have loved ones in the past, harm's away the next time. I wanted to get your comment.
Well, just to make it brief, because I know we don't have much time, I would just, reiterate again that they may well be terrorists and they may well not be entitled to prisoner of war status, but the United States has obligated itself to make that determination according to certain rules. And if the United States is going to uphold the rule of law, then it seems to me that it's necessary for it to follow its own laws and the obligations that it's incurred under the international system. One of the charges against these individuals, not legal charges because there haven't been any legal charges made, but the political charges made by members of the administration, is that they were acting as unlawful combatants. They were violating the laws of war. Now, if we're going to go after people for violating the laws of war and the rule of law, then it seems to me that we are recognizing that we should have an obligation ourselves to uphold the rule of law and to follow the legal obligations that we've incurred.
We will have to stop there because we have come to the end of the time. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, hear some more discussion of these issues, you do have a couple of opportunities. David Cohen will be talking tonight on the U of I campus at 7:30, Witnessing War Crimes Trials. This is an event in the MillerCom series at the Levis Center. That's open to anybody who would like to attend. Also, there'll be a panel discussion on war crimes, restitution, and reconciliation with U of I faculty members tomorrow night at 8 in the auditorium of the University of Illinois College of Law. That's organized by the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities and is also free and open to the public. Our guest, David Cohen, is director of the War Crimes Study Center at University of California at Berkeley, where he is also professor of rhetoric and classics. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.